afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Sonia Hilgren and I'm acting chair of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club and Washington editor of Farm Journal. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, June 15th, Pamela Moraldo, president of Planned Parenthood, will talk about redefining the pro-choice movement. And on Friday, June 18th, Dr. Robert Ballard, undersea explorer with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and discoverer of the Titanic, will describe his recent trip to Guadalcanal and discuss his search for the Lusitania. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include former ambassador to Russia, Robert Strauss, EPA Administrator Carol Browner, U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno, South African President F.W. de Klerk, Postmaster General Marvin Runyon, and Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. Improving the moral, social, and political environment through greater social and individual responsibility is the aim of communitarians who have created a nationwide network to promote their beliefs. While President Clinton has not officially adopted the communitarian platform, several of his stands, such as those on workfare and national service, parallel communitarian principles. Communitarians considered it a victory when the new president appointed a leading communitarian, William Galston, as domestic policy advisor. Heading up this group, which puts strengthening the community and individual responsibility before partisanship, is Dr. Amitai Etzioni, professor at George Washington University and founder of the communitarian movement. He was born in Germany, raised in Israel, and came to the United States in 1957. People sometimes call him on the telephone and begin speaking Italian to him, but he's not. Amittai is an Old Testament name. Amittai was the father of Jonah, who was swallowed by a whale. And Etzioni is a region in Israel. Dr. Etzioni is editor of a communitarian quarterly and the Responsible Community Rights and Responsibilities and author of 14 books, including one considered the communitarian textbook called The Spirit of Community Rights, Responsibilities, and the Communitarian Agenda. Dr. Etzioni's achievements in social sciences have been acknowledged by several fellowships, including those given by the Guggenheim Foundation and the Social Science Research Council. He founded the Center for Policy Research in 1968 and continues as its director today. Communitarians have been called a cross between libertarians and Republicans, with a little bit of socialism mixed in. Joining us here at the National Press Club to clarify any confusion about the movement is Dr. Amitai Etzioni. Please join us in welcoming him.
Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be with you here and discuss some ideas and ideals which are very close to my heart. I'd like to start by telling you about a dream I had as I was drafting the Spirit of Community. I usually don't talk about these things in public, but you'll see in a moment why I think it may contribute to what I'm trying to share with you. I was dreaming that it would be one of those rare books which start a nationwide conversation, like Betty Friedan's book on the feminine mystique and Michael Harrington, The Other America, or Ralph Nader, Unsafe at Any Speed. I wasn't hoping to hit the bestseller list and retire on the profits or get a prize, but I thought it could serve as a way to trigger a dialogue. Why was it important to me? When you look as a sociologist, which is my training, under how a nation, how a society redirects itself. And you look at various turning points in our last 50 years, you'll find that at each point we had a nationwide dialogue, we talked and yelled some at each other, billions of hours of conversation in coffee clutches and water coolers and on talk shows, and out of it a change of direction arises. So for instance, if you take Silent Spring, which is closest to my heart from all those I mentioned, when Rachel Carson wrote that book, the environment was not on the map. It wasn't even an issue. People thought they could dump things out of the windows and into the waters without that being any problem at all. And then came the book and Earth Day and other things. And out of this came a grand conversation on what we owe our environment. And while some people think we went too far and we are crazy about snail darters, and others think we don't attend enough to, let's say, the warming of the Earth, I don't think anybody would challenge the fact that as a result of that conversation, we changed our direction. We changed our values, we changed the way we feel about the environment. Our purpose here was to do the same thing which the first environmental movement did to nature, to the body society. And it's our hypothesis that just the way the lakes and the rivers and the air has been suffering, that we dumped things on the community and we presumed it could deal with it all, and it is crumbling. Let me just give you one fact. You're all too familiar with these statistics, but that one may just help me move on. When a study was done in the 40s of school teachers, and they were asked what problems are on the top of the list which concerned them, it was chewing gum, talking about standing in line, and not putting the chairs back when the kiddies get up. When that was repeated in 1992, on top of the list was drugs, rape, and murder. So if anybody needs a quick reminder that things are different, I think these two figures should suffice. It's also a fact that each on an average day, 135,000 children take loaded guns to school because they're afraid for their safety. Things are wrong out there, and we need to talk about them. The reason we need to talk about them, because the only way we'll change them in a big fundamental way is not by passing half a dozen laws, but by having this grand conversation about what's right and what's wrong again, not returning to the past, but a new consensus which then will provide the foundation for rebuilding of the community and its various institutions. Now, I can't do justice to the whole agenda, and I very much like to leave time for discussion, so I'm just going to focus on two elements, hoping that some of you will turn to the text for the most of it. I'd like to focus on the question of how we need to deal with the relationship between rights and responsibilities, and then I will turn to the politics of virtue. The question of rights and responsibilities takes the following form. That is part of this development over the last 30 years is that ever more members of our society felt strongly that they're entitled to a large range of services and rights, and they kept expanding the list. Most recently, a lot of people talk about the right to health care. And I want to emphasize, and we keep getting into a misunderstanding here, that I have no trouble at all with people feel strongly about their rights. And in fact, as an immigrant, the reason I chose to live in this society is because of the enormous respect I have of its tradition, as reflected in the Bill of Rights, and this respect it has for individual rights, which no other society quite completely imitates. Now, the problem is that there is another side to the coin, that strong rights presume strong responsibilities. And what I'm afraid is, is not that we were concerned with strong rights, but that we forgot the other half of the equation. There's a social science finding, by itself not that important, but it kind of served like the famous apple which hit Newton's forehead and got him going studying the field of gravity. I was teaching ethics at the Harvard Business School, and I was kind of flipping some material, and I came across that finding that young Americans feel very strongly, as they ought to, that they have a right to be tried before a jury of their peers if they have been caught having committed a crime. But when they were asked if they could serve on a jury, they partly to a person said, let somebody else do it. And if you just roll this over your tongue, if you just let that sink in, it's really all in there, that little finding. The illogic of it, you cannot have a jury of your peers if the peers will not serve on it, and the indecency of it, that people want to take but they don't want to give. And let me tell you flatly that no society can survive if everybody wants to take and nobody wants to give. So a major part of our agenda is to have that conversation and raise responsibilities so they will match again our important list of rights. That's the easy part. The difficulties come, and very complicated issues arise when you talk about specifics. And what I'd like to do quickly is just share with you some of those, not because I have the answers, but as part of that effort to create a conversation, a dialogue. Let's take the hidden subsidies which physicians get, about $70,000 for each year they're in medical school. Now, let me be precise here. I'm not talking about scholarships or loans they get for which they supposedly will do some service. I'm talking about the fact that a medical student who pays in full tuition is still benefiting from federal and state subsidies which enable the teaching hospital function at the tune of $70,000 a year. Now let me ask you a question. We are now in a stage where we say we are so tight of money that we're going to tell welfare mothers who may have 2 or 3 young children that if the kids are late for school, we're going to deduct from their allowance. If the kids take drugs, we're going to cut their allowance. If they have another child, we're going to cut. We are telling now disadvantaged youth that if they will work 2 years for minimum wage, we may give them $5,000 to go to college. Are we entitled to ask from people who don't need a scholarship and didn't ask for a loan to do something back for their country when we coughed up $70,000 a year for them for quite a few years in a row? Let's take an even more touchy issue. Touchy to the point that I have not seen anybody discussing it. Certainly not in these terms. We talk these days about gay rights. I think it's a conversation we should have. It's another one of those grand dialogues we have in which we sort out our feelings. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, they have the same right to serve in the armed forces as anybody else, as long as they conduct themselves properly, and the same would hold for heterosexuals. But are we entitled, and it's a question, to ask what are their special responsibilities? We face an epidemic with no real cure in sight. The casualties are spreading rapidly. Are we entitled to ask them? I don't want to answer it. I want to have a discussion on the question that if you are a likely carrier, you should volunteer to come forward and be tested. If you're found to be a carrier, that you will warn your previous contacts. It's a conversation we should have. We should not avoid asking the other side of the question of rights. And in one area, the communitarian group came to a tentative conclusion, and it's another example of exercising the point I'm trying to illustrate. When it comes to drug testing, we try to draw a line where there's a compelling reason and where there's none. And we suggest to you as our tentative conclusion that when the life of others are directly involved. For instance, if you drive a school bus, that we will ask you if there is a violation of privacy involved, and there is, that you will yield to a test because you directly have the life of others in your hand. We would say the same thing about pilots, people who control the air traffic, and some others. So these are three quick examples of the complex ethical issues we need to talk about if we're going to right the imbalance between rights and responsibilities. Let me turn to others which have a little different nature. One of the most important sociological insights is, and that's really basically what the book is all about, is that the underpinning of the law, of the orderly society, it really lies in shared values. And when you have shared values, you barely need the laws, and when you don't have them, as we learned during Prohibition, the law doesn't do you much good. And so our real concern is not only or even mainly with the legal expression or constitutional expression of these issues, but with the underlying values we have to come to share. And we're using two pegs, frankly, of issues which by themselves are important, but important to us twice. First, for what they deal with, second, for what they bring up. The first one concerns organ donation. It's just, we are short of those organs. We're losing about 20,000 lives a year because we cannot find enough donors. And the typical conversation I have is with like a friend of mine, a very progressive woman, who says, oh my God, every time I go to the motor vehicle department, I forget to mark this on my license. And we want to say to one another, we want to start a conversation on the question, should we change this 180 degrees around? Should we say to one another that the civic thing to do, the decent thing to do, is to allow your organs to give somebody sight or life? And we assume that you realize that's your civic duty. And if you don't want to do that, you'll check out. As you check these days, as you know, when you go to the hospital, you have to fill out God knows how many forms anyhow. There will be one more form saying, I refuse. You have to give no reason. We don't take anybody's right away. If they don't want to, that's fine. But we create a culture, a climate, where this is expected. We make it much easier also on the hospital staff. We don't have to come to somebody as they're dying or to their family and say, hey, how about it? One last example. We're working on a paper on what I'm calling in the book super vows. And the notion is that we are concerned about the fact that people take marriage all too lightly. And we think that if people would enter marriage more seriously, there would be less breakups, which even if they're sometimes necessary, they're always troubling for the partners and above all for the children. Now, we don't want to pass a law like there used to be, which made divorce very difficult. But what we want to do is create like a new premarital contract in which people voluntarily could declare and saying, I want a higher order of commitment. And that will take the form that if there is trouble in the marriage, I agree ahead of time that if one wants to go to counseling, the other will come along. If somebody shouts divorce, we'll agree to wait at least 6 months. We can fill out the text. By people doing that voluntarily, we avoid any notion of imposition. But if this idea would catch on, it would become chic to say, hey, I have a super vow marriage. We hope to send a signal that we're taking family serious again. And that's the perfect transition to my second and only other theme I can go into today. And that is that when you come to the basic values of a society, beyond this rights and responsibilities stuff, you come to the question of what institutions nourish and support the sense of value. The values do not fly in thin air. They need embodiment in the body of society. That is what, in effect, I think Hillary Clinton is talking about when she talks about the politics of meaning, when she reminds us, as reminding we need, that we have spiritual and transcendental needs beyond our material needs, and that those need to be spoken to. She did a wonderful first step by calling attention to the politics of meaning. I like to add an inch to it by talking about what those meanings ought to be. We come back to the family. The traditional family presumed that, as you all know, mothers at home, fathers out bringing in the bacon. The more recent liberal tradition has been anything goes, there is no one pattern, and the family may be dead anyhow. And most people are willing to grant that it's an endangered species. We are looking for a third formula. We do not want to go back to the 50s, but we're asking, can we conceive of a family somewhat along the lines of Betty Friedan's unknown book, The Second Stage, of thinking about fathers and mothers who have exactly the same rights and exactly the same responsibilities, both more committed to their children? What if instead of bashing Murphy Brown, we would celebrate the Huxtables of two professionals, each having a job, but each very committed to one another and to their children? That is where the first line of defense is. Children are born without values. I want to emphasize it. It's such an elementary thing, and still I find people a little puzzled about that. It's a fact that if you leave a child without educating it, and I'm not talking about wiping their backs and seeing them run to the street, but without educating it, it will have no values at all. It will have no human features. There was a case in California which was reported in great detail in the New Yorker about a year ago about some couple who was embarrassed about their child, and they left in a chicken coop in the back of the yard for 5 years till she was found, and she was calling on four and barking. And that's the same finding we have from other places. So unless somebody educates the young and introduces even humanity to them, they won't have any. And by my estimate, roughly half the families, for various reasons, not of their own doing, economic pressures, stresses, other reasons, sometimes careers and ambition, are no longer sufficiently there to attend to the value education of their children. We have this very lame, transparent excuse that we're going to use quality time to make up for our absence. If those of you are not familiar with the idea is that you come home kind of exhausted with a briefcase full of work somewhere at 8 o'clock, and you call Jimmy over and say, "Hey, Jimmy, now is the time. Let's relate." The most recent twist on this is quality phone calls. Between a job and a date, you call her home and say, "Hey, Jimmy, love you, bye." It doesn't work like this. I not only study this matter, I have five sons, and I assure you that quality time occurs within quantity time. When you wash dishes, go fishing, play basketball, at some unexpected moment, the child is open to discussion, to education, to values. The fact, though, is that about half the families no longer deliver. And then we, by default, have to turn to the second line of defense, to the schools, and it's my considered judgment that they must help us in this area. They must participate in character development and, to say the word, in the transmission of values. And every single time, and I must share this idea with hundreds of groups across the country, it's not a single time I wasn't asked what seems to be the critical question in people's mind: whose values you're going to teach? And for many people, it seems like a trump card. They throw on the table and leave, because they know there's no answer, and therefore, why discuss it anymore? The answer is actually relatively simple. Let's teach those values we all share. It's a surprisingly long list. I don't know anybody who believes that discrimination is a moral value. I mean, we all acknowledge it happens all too often. But if we teach young people that discrimination is anti-ethical, I don't see who's going to protest. The notion that we should treat everybody with dignity, that truth-telling is better than lying. There's a long, long list. I could spend the rest of my time just listing them. And it's true, that's a little question at the margins. If you have a dying cancer patient and she didn't ask you questions, are you obliged to tell her the whole truth, you're going to die soon, or are you allowed to engage in the white lie? And it's relatively easy to deal with that, too. If you're really out for her benefit and not to advance you, it's okay. But we don't have to agree on every last detail, but basic principles the school will have to transmit. And then we come to a difficult question. If you talk to principals and teachers and such in most parts of the country, they would say, that's all very nice, but our cup flows over as it is. And people want us to deal with drugs and alcohol and math and English and science and foreign languages, just only that much we can carry. And I think it's a fair challenge. And I think if you are serious as a member of school boards and parents and such, and we want them to take that on as a mission, we have to come back and say, fine, you can remove home economics. Or we have to find something else. It's not possible in days of tight budgets to simply ask teachers to deliver more. And part of the conversation we'll have to have is what is going to stay on the plate and what's going to be taken off. And two more steps to go. We need to talk about the community itself, the neighborhoods. And let me tell a quick story here which will speak for what I'd like to share with you. In the year I served in the White House, suddenly 250,000 Marielitos, Cubans, took to paddle boats and other tires and such that appeared in Miami, practically within 1 week. And there was a certain amount of panic. What do you deal? How can you handle so many people? And I suggested that we'll call in a large number of voluntary associations and ask them to take it on as kind of an emergency project to show what they can do. And somebody else argued that we should create another government agency because there was a new problem. Remember, there was a Democratic administration. And I lost the debate. And Victor Palmieri was appointed the head of a new agency, Refugee Resettlement. You would not be surprised to know it still exists. And he got himself a budget and hired civil servants and set out to take care of the Cubans. By the time he got to Miami, all but 5,000 of the Cubans disappeared. And their families, their neighbors, their friends, Catholic charities took care of them, found them jobs, found them housing, start teaching them English. We kept hearing about the 5,000 criminals and mental patients which gave us all of trouble. I haven't seen the story been told how all the rest were taken care of by their community. And of course, you can see this every day now. It's an old American tradition. Immigrants are taken care of by their community. If you go to New York, Jews coming from Russia. If you go to Arlington, Vietnamese. It's working all over the place. So the principle we derive from that is that first we expect everybody to do the best they can for themselves. Second, to draw on their family. Thirdly, on their community. And the government step in, and it needs to step in, for great inequities, but not as the first resort, but as the last resort. And finally, a very vexing issue. As you build up communities, as you strengthen communities, you have to worry about the fact they will not turn hostile to one another. They will not have the kind of tribalism which you see all over the world raising its ugly head in Canada, causing bloodshed in Yugoslavia, India, Sri Lanka, the former Soviet Union, all over the place. We are not immune to that, as you saw in Los Angeles. And there are answers to that, and let me be coming out again with a somewhat different position. On the one hand, you have people who argue that we should have a melting pot in the sense of removing those particular heritages we all have, those hyphens, as they talk to them, and all blend into one homogenized American culture. Somebody called it a great solvent, like a paint remover, which will remove the traces of our heritages. As a sociologist, I don't see the merit of that at all. I see no problem whatsoever. On the contrary, a source of enrichment for this country if people will maintain their traditional cuisines, dances, religious practices, be proud of their heritage. What we cannot abide by is if each group turns into a tribe which does not recognize that they're part of an overarching community. That we need to have not only particular values, but also shared values which kind of provide the frame for the mosaic. The mosaic can be as colorful and as rich as we can make it, as long as we are all bound together by the framework. Then you come to the question, what belongs under the framework? For instance, the superiority of the democratic process. We all know that it has many difficulties and limitations. As many people observed before me, it's full of flaws and only the best system there is. And so we need to teach that to each generation, to each group of immigrants. And we should not, in my judgment, just put it as a cafeteria. You want authoritarianism, you want tyranny. There's another taste called democracy. Second, the Bill of Rights. The study upon study shows that we need to reteach it all the time. There are a lot of Americans who don't know it and don't believe in it and need to come to share their commitment to that essential framework. And, of course, the tolerance to one another, mutual respect, is essential for society with all these differences so we can live together in peace. There is a fourth element which is much more controversial, and I learned to say with great reluctance because you're called racist for just mentioning it, and I'll take the risk, you know, and I'll leave immediately after the presentation. Some people think that we need to have a shared language, that we all need to speak English. And that's a debatable question. In Switzerland, we are told they do quite nicely without it, but people sometimes forget to mention that the Swiss were fighting each other for 1,000 years until in 1848 they became this loving community we associate them with now. I don't want us to have 1,000 years of warring before we learn to live with each other. Maybe we should have a shared ability to talk to one another. Well, these are not decisions. These are things whose purpose is to provoke discussion on what our new environment, our social moral environment, should look like. I had that dream. The reason I really mention it to say that there's just a small possibility that it will be realized. The communitarian movement which arose around our text is really startling. We started the whole thing during the countdown to the war in the Gulf. We expected no response whatsoever. The public was mesmerized with happening there. We got a tremendous response in the press. People write into us, politicians endorse us. Gore came as when he was a senator and spent a lot of time with us. So do people from other parties. Jack Kemp has many ideas which are similar to ours. We are not partisan. We have people from both sides of the aisle. There is a beginning of a dialogue. That's why I came here, and that's why I'm so delighted to continue the conversation with you on the question, what should be our social and moral environment in the years to come? Thank you.